It's Wednesday, January 3rd, 2007, and you're listening to episode 33 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan. And despite the fact that everyone is sitting all askew again, I'm still going to introduce people in the traditional order.
You bastard.
So sitting on my left is Chad.
Howdy.
On my right is Adam.
Hi.
And straight down the middle is John.
Hey.
So how was your guys' New Year's?
There wasn't a lot of vomit from me.
No, but one of my fellow partygoers, I believe, puked after I passed out like a good house guest.
Sorry, Renaissance Wolf.
Yeah, thank you, Renaissance Wolf, for hosting the pseudo-official Fear the Boot New Year's party. There's an invite on the forums to anyone that lived in the area and could make it. Thank you for doing that. We apologize for everything that Chad did last night.
It's always a sink, Chad. It's never a toilet.
I had a good time. What can I say? It is a great party. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, and a lot of wine.
We all know.
All right. Before we dig into all the good stuff we've got to do today, I actually want to thank somebody for something, and I was thinking about doing this in the form of email, but really what he did was such an above and beyond cool thing to do that I want to do it on the episode instead. So on behalf of all the hosts, I want to thank Joey Jojo Jr. Shabadoo, I think is his forum name. His real name is Scott. So I want to take a moment to thank Scott. This past Christmas, he sent a gift card to Amazon to all four of us sitting here. Given the amount on those gift cards, he did not just spend like $5. I mean, he sent us a pretty nice gift. So, Scott, I want to really thank you for doing that, because that was extremely cool and obviously not something you had to do. So
thanks, man. We
thanks,
appreciate
dude.
It.
Yeah, the thanks. Ego boost was worth at least as much as the actual monetary value of the certificate, which, as Dan mentioned, was substantial.
In my case, this is going back into the show because I used my gift card to order two handbooks on farming.
I used mine to blunt the price of the first season of Deep Space Nine.
You know, Dan, that doesn't help our argument that the game is not only about
I know.
Farming.
Yeah, I know, and this is probably something that's going to restart that up again. So, okay, I'll just go ahead and lie and tell everyone that that was a lie, and in fact, I ordered...
Spent it on porn.
I spent it purely on porn and ballistic information.
Yes. So.
There we go.
I'm going to use mine to buy an ape that we can shoot to test ballistic information.
Cool.
Amazon sells ballistic
apes, and yeah, and stuff. Shooting apes. As they... This is going to be an awesome bonus episode. Tune in and listen to us plug a mountain gorilla.
Listen to us try to shoot past the PETA demonstrators.
All right, Chad, let's talk about gaming shops and how not to run them.
I was thinking that we should do something that's sort of like a common player mistakes, common GM mistakes, something in that vein, only about gaming shops. Because I was in a gaming shop the other day that really kind of made me mad.
No, Chad, something irritated you and you want to tell us about it?
That's right.
No.
I think this also came up on the forums because somebody was talking about being in a gaming shop, and I wish I had the forum poster's name. Probably should have looked it up. But this guy was talking about being in a gaming shop, and the people there were apparently really pretty ignorant to him.
Yeah, my experience was nothing compared to this guy. He was talking about this shop up in Canada. They were having a game of some sort. I forget what the actual event was, but the game before that, they had a tournament before that for Yu-Gi-Oh! Players, the card game. And so there was a whole bunch of kids there. And then it ended, and most of the kids left, and then they started this next event. There were these three or four kids sitting at a table in the back, keeping quiet, playing a couple of hands of Yu-Gi-Oh! While they waited for their parents to show up. And they weren't causing a ruckus or anything, and this guy was a part of the second event. And he was part of it. He wasn't being disturbed by these guys. Everything was cool. The owner of the shop walked over to these kids and just started screaming at them. She was like, "This tournament's over. You need to leave now." I mean, these kids are probably, one of them's in a wheelchair.
Wow.
Yelling at to basically get out of the store. I jumped on their website just out of curiosity, and there was like some really weird things in it. Like they give their mission statement for the store, which is, you know, provide customer service and all, you know, typical mission statement stuff. And then at the end of it, it said, "We don't do fad games or fad card games. We have nothing to do with that. We don't promote the flavor of the week when it comes to card games and stuff like that.
There's nothing but that.
You mean you don't market?
Yeah. You don't sell what people want to buy is what you're saying. Yeah. I mean,
and yet they're running Yu-Gi-Oh! And Magic tournaments. But anyway...
But those have been around forever.
After that, though, they said, we also sell products at the lowest price we can sell them to you, unless, of course, something to the effect of, unless, of course, you really want to pay more money for them, and then we've never turned away a customer like that, we'll gladly take your money and say, come back again. It's like, so wait a minute. You don't sell what people would want, and then right, you're totally willing to overcharge.
Let me pause you. There are so many issues here that, John, you talk about taking a mental number two. This is going to be like a mental explosive diarrhea.
It already is.
I need to like start breaking this down into pieces that we can chew. So let's start
off. Chew diarrhea, Dan. Could you please modify that analogy?
You have to break it down into flushings.
Okay. It's a multi-flusher. All right, go.
All right, so flush number one. Let's start out with a gaming shop that is so elitist it will not sell what people want. Now, sitting here at Fear the Boot, we've been accused of being elitist. There's probably some truth to it. We have taste about what we play, what we do with our time, because it's my time, my fun, or lack of fun. But when you're selling things in a store, what you like is completely irrelevant. You are supposed to sell what people want to buy. Why in God's name would you refuse to sell things just because it's beneath you?
Yeah.
And we're not talking like, well, flavor of the month because we're going to have to pay a ton to stock it and no one's going to buy it. We're not talking
they're not stocking offensive things like a new board game comes out about pedophilia. And that's just completely offensive, and they won't carry it. That's totally understandable.
Well, Dan, you did mention...
the True 20 NAMBLA.
The unreliability of fad games, and it could be a business move that they're trying to wrap a pretty bow on and say, well, we're caring for you, the customer.
I don't know. From what I'm hearing about this place, it probably isn't.
If they were going to wrap a pretty bow on it, they wouldn't have put it in such a negative connotation.
The front page of their website, they were selling a Little Mermaid board game.
Little Mermaid is perennial.
Silence on the podcast.
You know, it's not just this store. There was a store here in St. Louis where at the height of Magic cards, a friend of mine went in there to buy some Magic cards. I never got that into Magic, but I knew a lot of people that did. And he went in there to buy Magic cards. I mean, the guy just about went off on him. Like, oh, we won't carry that crap, and I don't believe in this. It's like, once again, it's like, dude, these things, I mean, nobody could keep these things in stock.
Yeah.
There were CCGs are selling them.
Licenses to print money. I mean, Wizards, how much do they make on selling a player's handbook? I don't think it's a lot. I think their margins on the big hardbacks aren't very good at all. How much do they make on selling a pack of 15 Magic cards? Everything. It's paper.
Phil told me he bought the first like a starter pack for the World of Warcraft CCG, and you know he's going to spend $200 on it. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to get into that $200. Well, hey, just slide right off the table.
We were the ones that bought the boxes of Decipher Star Wars cards in like 2004, 10 years after the game was dead and buried.
They didn't even make the big game. Packs?
No. Yeah. We carry them in our wallets, Adam. We can't even talk.
Love that game.
That game is
me
awesome.
Me too. It's great.
All right. Flush, that's first flush. Second flush. A store that is based purely on the goodwill of its customers. Because let's face it, with a gaming shop, you talk about a good successful gaming shop, you were talking about building a little community.
Yeah.
Because right now, the gaming shops in general are suffering from competition from bookstores, from online retail.
Yeah, the internet.
And of course, even...
Not even online retail, online production. World of Warcraft, play Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, even completely different hobbies like video games. And when I think back through my life, the gaming stores that I've been really attached to, it was always because the owner was a cool guy and we hung out and talked and I had friends that went there and we'd sit around in back playing games. And of course, when you're sitting around in back, you make the inevitable trek up front to buy other things.
Yeah.
Or on your way through the store, you saw something cool, or between rounds, you were browsing the shelves and ended up buying something. Mm-hmm. And for a store to just be outright ignorant to the people that are in there, buying things from them.
This guy on the forums, and I'm sorry, I do not remember who started this conversation on our forums. I wish I could. But this guy on our forums was even like, the two guys who run it are your typical sort of fat beard elitist comic book guy. I mean, they're just like such jerks and totally like, oh, well, we don't do that. Or it's like, this isn't a library type guys.
Yeah, I remember that too when we were growing up. Chad, you and I kind of like magic cards. We never got really into comic books, mm-hmm. but we had friends that were really into comic books. And I remember going into a comic shop it was a comic shop out in the South St. Louis city.
Yeah.
And while we were in there, a friend of ours was flipping through the comics, which is what he typically did before buying them. Just kind of thumb through and make sure that.
Oh, that friend was me. I picked it up.
Yeah.
And I opened it.
Oh, was it you? I thought it was Alex. No, it was me.
I picked it up and I opened it and I was going to buy this. And it was like one of those, I'm picking it up to open it as I'm turning to walk through the cash register. And the guy's like, this ain't a library.
Yeah. And threw us out.
And then, yeah, put the comic book down, walked out the door, did not get my money.
You showed him.
He's still around, actually.
Where is he? What's his store?
His store is on, it's in South St. Louis on Hampton Road. It's like Comics Universe.
Oh,
yeah,
we might have a place for stuff. I passed that place going down to Pueblo Solis for margaritas last week.
We also we also put up a Fear the Boot flyer in his store, too.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, for the Archon cast. Yeah. So he might be listening to this right now. Go to
You know, and of course, we don't know who it was. I don't know if this is the owner or just the guy.
Yeah, the same guy. These things change unless they don't.
It's the same guy.
Okay.
You can't remember something that happened a week ago, but you remember this guy from like 10 years ago.
That was more
this guy made him look cool. You never, ever forget that.
Huh.
Yeah, let's talk about gaming stores that are doing this right. I have been really impressed with that store you guys have been going to with Clix.
Clix is awesome.
Is cool.
Yep. Clix is everything you want out of a gaming store. It has a little bit of comics. It has board games, like the cool board games, you know, Settlers of Catan and Ticket to Ride.
There's lots of those, actually.
Tons and tons of that stuff. They've got, like, all the accessories. They got all the dice. They got all the, like, for miniatures, they have the glue and whatnot and the paints and everything. They have a real diverse store. The store is, God forbid, clean. You know how many comic book shops I've gone into that have an odor to them?
Yeah.
Or have stains on the wall?
Or is it the clientele?
It's a little... Well, you know what? You go to Clix, and there's a dork community, so it's generally the same clientele, I would imagine.
But on the other hand, there's the mall thing going on. They've got to appeal to the passerby, whereas a store out on a road somewhere that you have to drive to get to might not necessarily have people wandering through it.
I've only been in the store twice, and both times because we were walking by Emelina saw Cthulhu's.
Yeah.
They have a lot of Cthulhu's drawn in, and I'm like, oh, where are you going?
Yeah. And the people there are super nice.
Yeah, from the community standpoint, they've always got little games going on in back, encourage people to hang out there. And
there's a comic book shop in St. Louis called the Fantasy Shop. And they're actually really popular. Like, they're on the top five lists of the most influential names in comic books because they're...
Was this 5 years ago?
No, this is recent. The Fantasy Shop is, the, from my understanding, the largest comic book shop franchise in the country.
Really?
Even after all the closings?
Yes.
Wow.
Because they're in other states, too. And they're based out of St. Louis. I mean, somebody might call me on this and...
I mean, try to think of the target of comic shops. I can't do it. I mean, there is no national chain. There's no GameStop for Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah. But, no, when you go into a fantasy shop and talk to the guys, the people behind the counter are farming what you're saying for information to suggest more products for you to buy. You just cannot walk into this comic shop and chat about comics or role-playing games or something like that and say, hey, like, oh, yeah, I play that. That's really cool. Oh, I know, you know, Batman's doing this week. And, yeah, who thought of that? It's like, you go in there, it's like, oh, hey, Batman's doing this week. And he's like, oh, yeah, Batman. You know, if you like Batman, you might like this Batman Daredevil team up over here. And if you like time you talk to these people and it clicks, it's completely different. You can go in and have a conversation with the employees.
And, you know, I think this is kind of an idiosyncrasy of gaming and comics in this sort of subculture. Because if I walk into Target to buy a towel, I really don't care if the girl behind the counter knows a damn thing about bath towels.
Right.
But
you want your towel.
I just want my towel and I want to leave. But when I walk into a gaming store or comic store, you just kind of expect that person behind the counter to love these things and love them not just so they're knowledgeable on them so they can recommend things or point things out, but love them also just so that you can kind of go in there and immerse yourself in that, that you're talking to a fellow fan just for the enjoyment of talking to a fellow fan. And I'm not even sitting here kind of self-querying, I'm not sure, why do I expect that out of a gaming store or comic store and I don't any other store on the face of the earth?
It's easy because I get the same thing out of a cigar shop. I smoke cigars, and I get the same thing out of a couple of cigar shops I go to. I love cigars.
Right.
I also love underground comics, role-playing games, and board games. I love them. They're my hobby. So I go to a place where I can buy these things, and other people love them as well. When I go to Target, I don't love towels. The girl behind the counter should not love the towel. I don't go to Target to make a friend about towels.
I do.
Well, that's you.
And you're a freak.
I know.
You and your Hero the Hero shirt.
And listen, Heroes is a great show, and I'll hear no ill talk from people who haven't watched it.
I never said anything bad about it.
I just dissed your shirt, not your show. Please continue, Chad.
No, the hero thing totally sidetracked me. Thanks for that.
Right, people Adam. Loving towels.
You pointed it out on my shirt. Oh, wait, no, that was Dan.
Anyway, so, yeah, I think the steam has kind of run out on me on hating.
And the paid spot by Clix has run out.
Yeah.
Time to move on.
Clix only paid us for a 5-minute bit, so we're going to have to roll on to the next topic. All right, speaking of hating things, I have another little banter topic for us before we get into today's game design subject.
You've kept the secret from us for two
long
days.
Yeah, I have. And I think you guys have built this up. See, I told these guys I had a banter topic, and I wasn't going to tell them what it is. And the reason is because I think we'll get the most interesting conversation when I bring this up fresh. They haven't had time to plan the responses.
So we made a list.
Yeah, these guys
Dan has.
These guys have built it up to everything from I'm about to move,
Carla's pregnant.
Sex change.
Won the lottery. Sex change.
You bought a Wii. We thought you kind of...
Which I did buy a Wii, but that's not...
You'll
like
love
a,
it.
That's not a Guaranteed. Show announcement.
I made my Mii today. It was great.
All right. So here is what I wanted to talk about. We, on the forums, were talking about how it is easier to bash things than to love them. All right. And I want to talk about this from a specific angle because I think I see this here on the show. In fact, I'll admit I see this in myself. And I also know for a fact I see this in at least one other chat on the show. When you bash
standards.
No, and I don't think it's that. Bashing something is easier than loving something because to love something, you have to put yourself out there. All right. Let me explain that. If I sit here and I can say Rift sucks. I can put myself kind
you
of...
would be correct.
Probably would be. But what I can do with that statement is put myself up on a moral high ground where I have not exposed myself specifically to any criticism. Whereas if I turn around and say instead that I love a different game or I like certain things about a game,
then you'll have to
I have
the
now
defensive.
Opened myself up to criticism. And so I have to wonder, you know, this happens on this show, and I fully admit that, but I see it, it's not just here. This is a human thing. That is it easier to talk about why you hate something because it puts you in a safer position than talking about why you love something?
I don't know that it puts you in a safer position.
I don't know either.
I think that people expect you to defend your hate less than they do than your, like, if you love something.
But I don't see that from the people around me. When I say that I dislike something... and I start giving arguments on why, people take me to task on it. Because it is like this, and this is just to me, it's this waving banner of, oh my God, Chad hates something.
Well, Chad, you become progressively more incendiary until someone takes you to task on it. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You're trolling for
you bring that
for
I don't you think bring that,
I,
that
I
on yourself.
I don't troll on purpose. I think that
you don't
I,
troll on purpose, but you do troll.
I think that I am willing to point out the defects of something of things that are popular,
but you know, I rarely hear you juxtapose that with praising the positives of it.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying I'm saying this to you because you made the comment. I'm replying to you, but I have also seen this in myself.
I think that I do praise the positives of it because my thing is that I want to be realistic. I want to take something, we can say a product, a book, a movie, whatever, and I want to look at it as realistically as possible. I want to point out all the bad things about it, and I want to point out all the good things about it. We'll take Hero, for instance, a TV show. I've never seen it, so if I were to point...
It's
if I were
a very
to watch,
one-sided conversation.
Yeah, well, if I were to watch it, and I started pointing out all the negative things about it, Adam would stand up and say, no, you're wrong because of this, 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 and this. And I could be wrong, right? Doesn't matter. But you would defend it. Yeah. If I said Hero was good, here's some good things about it, you'd be like, Yeah, you're right. You know, I agree with you. That is some good things. I feel, I tried and do both, and the negative stuff and the resistance against the negative issues overshadow the good things that I say about
it. It can go the other way just as easily if you are talking about something you don't like to someone who likes it a lot. For example, mm-hmm. people come around, you know, I hate Deus Ex. Okay, you suck. I hate Lord of the Rings. Okay, I don't want to talk to you. You're right, Dan, to an extent, but even though hating is perhaps easier than loving, it's not infallible. You can't just hate, and be invincible forever.
Right.
Oh, I don't think that's the case. I was just, you know, I wasn't saying that it is some completely impenetrable fortress of rhetoric, but just more that I have to wonder if maybe this is just why people in general find it easier to bash than to praise. I remember having a similar conversation with someone, this was a while back, where they were going off on this or that news station. And I'm not going to start naming the stations. This is going to start bringing up political things. But they're going off on this particular network and that particular network. And anytime someone said, well, I prefer the news from this network, well, they had some attack on that network as well. And, of course, the question comes, okay, then what do you think is a good place to get the news? Which network would you prefer?
Was this me?
No, this was not you. At which point it goes quiet. There is no response to this. Because it's real easy to attack what everyone else says. But the minute this person says, well, I get my news from over here, well, now all of a sudden they are open to critique. Well, wait a minute. Your news source is this, this, and this.
People like to bitch. That's what this comes down to.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I don't want to set any New Year's resolutions because I think nobody ever keeps those. But one of the goals I have for myself during this new year, and this may or may not affect the podcast, is just in general, I want to try to be a more positive person, not like Pollyanna foolishly, everything's tulips and marshmallows, but let's get into some gaming advice. Today we are going to talk about the micro setting. Last time we talked about the macro setting of your game, we are now talking about the micro setting. So, per a little procedure for doing these things, let's start off with a definition of micro setting.
Tell me, Dan.
We are defining it as the people, places, and things that are relevant only to a small area of your game. All right, if you're talking about, let's say, the real world today, your macro setting are the people, places, and things that affect the world as a whole. The internet is part of your macro setting. The head of the UN is a part of your macro setting. Things like thin crust pizza in St. Louis are part of your micro setting. The mayor of Detroit is part of your micro setting. These are things that may have some effect on the world as a whole, but for the most part, their presence and effect is only realized at a small, limited area or geography.
Why are we doing this?
All right, well, the reason we have to do this is if you're trying to make a game for people to play in, you've got to know what the consistent things are across your world, because these things drive your story, like if you've got wars unfolding and such, and also help set some boundaries for the setting you're going to encounter along the way. But if you are playing, let's say, a Forgotten Realms campaign, ultimately, even if you have this war between Boromir and the Zentrum or whatever unfolding, you still, at this moment in time, are sitting in some particular vale or some particular town, talking to some particular person under the laws of some particular king. And these things have to be understood by the player in order to conduct the game. Just like right now, yes, my life is affected by the actions of presidents and leaders and generals, but my life is also affected by the cop that I encounter when I walk out my door, or the kinds of food that I have in my refrigerator right now, or the kind of religion that I practice, or all these things that are relatively local to this area. Now, unlike a macro setting, there are many micro settings. At the world scale, there's only one grand scheme of things that affect the world. There's only one internet. But on the micro setting, you have many different settings. The setting of St. Louis is different than the setting of Kansas City, which is different than the setting of LA, which is different than the setting of Reykjavik. So you have many micro settings. So you cannot think of this as a development process where you sit down, you start, you put the last letter on it, save the file, and you're done. This is something that you are going to do again and again and again all throughout the lifespan of your game. You have to do this once for every distinct locality that you have out there, which, depending on your game, could be cities, could be planets, could be...
How big would you think that an area should be?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I know.
As I just said, it's going to vary a little bit depending on the game. I guess really the answer is something is somewhat cultural. because you've got to look at really where can you kind of draw at least a fuzzy boundary between where one culture begins and another ends.
You mean like a kind of a setting bleed?
Yeah, and there's
you mean
always...
You shouldn't make EverQuest 1 zones where there's a little tunnel between the rectangles and a loading screen?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you should ever have anything quite that cheesy. I mean, maybe your setting may call for something like that.
No, I was joking. Your setting will never call for that.
But generally, no. But if you think of it this way, that... if you talk about there is a distinct cultural difference, let's say, between St. Louis and Chicago.
Yes.
Whereas I could not really say there's an extremely distinct cultural difference between St. Louis and, let's say, St. Charles County. You know, there's some difference, but it's probably not a difference that's great enough to really be worth talking about.
Probably not. You could do it in 3 bullet point footnotes.
Yeah, and I think there's somewhat... It's kind of a fuzzy logic here because, yeah, without the EverQuest zones, you can't really... cleanly break where one ends and the other begins, but you should at least intuitively be able to see some of these boundaries or convenient ways of lumping all this stuff together. And yeah, I guess for some games, this make it real easy. Like if you're talking about a game like Star Trek or Battletech or Star Wars.
Ooh, planets.
Planets.
Yeah.
Because planets don't touch each other unless you have some great cataclysm unfolding.
Or you could do it.
In which case, the setting doesn't matter anyway.
Or you could do it like a Civil War era role-playing game, because everything's divided by states, and the states are culturally isolated.
Yeah,
there's an overall culture, but then there's microcosms.
Except even then, there was a Confederate Missouri and a Union Missouri. There was a Confederate Tennessee and a Union Tennessee.
One of the things I think it's important to keep in mind when developing your micro-setting is to be consistent in what you say. Like, one of the things, I love the setting handbook that I have for Forgotten Realms, an old second edition paper-bound book.
Second edition.
But...
approved.
Gross. Blue pictures everywhere.
No, this was, I'm talking, well, it was second edition rules, but this is also the second edition of the setting, so I'm talking about second edition.
All right,
but one thing that kind of, though I liked a lot of what they did with the micro setting, one of the things that kind of bugged me about it was inconsistent. That if you looked at this particular city, they might have information on all the internal industries and trade caravans and all this economic information. You flip over to the next town, there's absolutely none of that there. And so we could begin a game where maybe they're guarding a trade caravan. It's like, wow, we know that up here, they love to make little trinkets and clocks and things like that. Let's export these. And where would we take them? And, well, we really don't know because no town anywhere nearby has any information on what's going on there economically.
So would you say a checklist is in order?
A checklist or, you know, maybe even some kind of an internal template. I don't want to jump ahead too much to what we're doing with Skies of Glass, but I guess it's kind of relevant, so we'll get into it a little bit. What we wanted to do was list out what we felt was important at a location, at any location. And we kind of wrote up a little template of these are the bullet points that have to be covered. And whenever we do a bit of micro setting, any particular city or state or township or whatever it may be, we are going to make sure that these bits of information are covered. And, you know, actually, this brings up a good question, though. When you're creating that template for your setting, what needs to be on there?
That was my next question, Dan.
Well, now I'm asking you.
I don't know. How broad do you want to be? How broad within your micro-specific setting do you want to get?
All right, well, let's say...
That's the question.
I know. I don't have an answer, so I was going to repose the question.
Let's say you're making a setting for D&D. Let's keep something fairly easy here.
Okay.
And you're sitting down to write up about the different townships that exist within your realm. How are you going to ascertain exactly what the bullet points are that you need to cover on each place as you're making up this kind of behind-the-scenes template you're going to apply to each of your little settings?
I think the DMG gives, like, 2 plot or bullet points
you're
about
kidding.
This factor. Yeah, they have racial composition and the maximum value of any one item in the town.
That is outrageous because coming off the top of my head, I can think of 3 separate categories of points. To
oh, yeah, I could think of 10
social,
that you
political,
need
and economic.
To know. Yeah, but
just straight off the top of my head,
book.
And then like 10 points under each of those.
But I guess the question I'm asking is really even preliminary to that, which is how do you arrive at the fact that those are significant, meaningful things to talk about?
They affect the culture. Yeah. They affect what a player character might be doing while he was in that town.
All 3 of those things have a big bearing on anybody's anyday life. And
yeah,
exactly. That's zone. One of the good ones I would start with is what does it take to enable a role-playing game? And if you go back to your roles, we talked a couple episodes ago about setting the player roles. If you go back to the kinds of things you're going to allow or enable or encourage people to do within your role-playing game, what is the information that you need to make that happen?
Yes. How can you make something of consequence out of a more or less static background? Are there caravans that are raided by pirates? Great. Are there terrible social schisms and rebel movements happening all the time? You got it. You know, so on and so forth. Try to have something that can be interesting if you look at it from a certain way.
Well, do you think yes and no questions are the way to go there?
No, but there is enough of such and such a dangerous or otherwise interesting element to make a plot, yes, or there isn't, no.
Do you guys think that you can make this form to comprise all games? Or do you have to make a separate and specific form?
You would have to tailor it to games. We're not going to have the racial composition of Skies of Glass. There are no dwarves in Los Angeles. Sorry,
you could have a racial composition.
That's true. Maybe stories are setting significant that in this particular place you have Jews and Arabs living together.
Okay, that's a good point.
Let me qualify.
Answer the question though.
Not ethnicity, race. Right. Can't breed with one another. The biological definition of race.
For example, another good thing thrown there with that is if we talk about Star Trek. Where there's no such thing as money. Talking about the economics of an area may really not be all that important.
Well, there's still gold plus platinum, though.
Yeah.
What they added in later because they need the Ferengi. Because the concept of not having an economy is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, let a woman touch your ears, not your lirums or whatever the hell the money is. One of the rules of acquisition.
Did you see somebody on the forum posted all of the rules of acquisition?
I think they did, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but anyways. I think definitely this has got to be unique to the game because each game is going to have its own needs. And I would take this back to look at your field. What are you trying to capture with the game? These are probably things you need to develop. Look at the roles. What kinds of things are people supposed to be doing? Which, of course, from that, you can also move forward a step to what kinds of games are people supposed to be running or what kinds of plots are you trying to enable? And right there, this is going to tell you what you need within your micro setting within Star Trek, assuming that you're not dealing with any of these things they added on later, you're talking about classic episodes. Well, who's wealthy on a planet just really is irrelevant to their setting most of the time. And so therefore, it's not something you need to consistently cover from one place to the next. You know, something else that you have to keep in mind about the micro setting is because of the fact that unlike the macro setting, this is dictating exactly what sorts of things the players can do in your game. Because now you're not just talking about the generic internet is out there. You're now talking about people live in these kinds of neighborhoods and interact with these kinds of police. The micro setting, unlike the macro setting, is going to be very easy to affect. For example, it's going to be a lot harder to bring down the internet than it would be to ruin someone's mom and pop shop on the corner of the street. These are things that you're hitting up against on a regular basis in your game.
Gotcha. So players can much more easily radically alter a micro setting than they can the macro setting.
So you need to keep that in mind when you're actually doing it.
To me, the micro setting is what the players are playing in. The macro setting and the macro story is the backdrop for everything.
The backdrop or maybe even the parameters for it.
Yeah.
Or maybe some aspect of the ultimate goal. Yeah, you can kill the Emperor at level 20, and it's the defining act of your campaign.
Something else to keep in mind with your micro setting is that while we are talking about, you know, one city being distinct from another, likely, and once again, this depends on the game itself, but in all likelihood, none of these places are an island.
I'm calling this setting bleed.
Okay, we will call it setting bleed. So there should always be some amount of setting bleed, where if you have town A that has a large amount of water and town B has no water, there's probably some kind of trade relationship or tension that's unfolding here. And that's something you should look for because these are going to give you opportunities to develop what may not even really be a worldwide story, but may nonetheless be an important local story that spills between these places.
And these are the stories and things that the players can interact with. The micro setting should be tools that the game designers give to game masters and players to provide hooks for things to do, to provide starting points for plots and stuff. So you don't just want to have a town, boom, this many people, this racial division, this annual income. Having all that information is important, but you need to start having more in there too. You need to start having like the thing about the water, you know, tensions, rivalries with other towns, things going on in the town, the sort of fluff that makes up a game.
Chad, that brings up an important point, which is you have to have the game plot in mind as you're writing the micro setting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I run a game, and I can't tell you how many times we've had this. Let's go back to Forgotten Realms once again, which does have micro setting there, where we wander into a town, and yeah, there may be kind of a few bullet points there on, well, there's farm fields to the east, there's a particular inn right here, but I never really have a sufficient sense of what's going on in the town, such that on the spot, I can really draw my characters into what makes that town unique. I mean, okay, it has farm fields to the east and it has an inn somewhere. Well, how many towns in Forgotten Realms have farm fields somewhere and an inn somewhere?
All you know, of them.
This doesn't really scream to me that when they walk in, these are the kinds of things that they're instantly getting drawn into. I would say that I think micro setting suffers from the same problem that macro setting does, which is in the vast majority of games out there, it is insufficiently developed. Right. In fact, I would say that there are more games out there that fail to develop the micro setting than the macro setting. We actually talked about one of our preferred games, BattleTech. This is probably the single greatest bone I have to pick with the game, is you have a lot of sense of what the cultures of the successor states are like and all the different personalities that drive them. You have a lot of macro setting information. You have no micro setting.
Right. Whereas with Shadowrun, on the other hand, Shadowrun did a fantastic job of it. Their micro setting is great.
Yeah, they gave tons of details, like even in the main book on what's going on in Seattle. They had a whole source book on Chicago.
Yeah, they had an entire book that gave micro settings for North America and had no rules in it whatsoever. Neo-Anarchist Guide to North America. And I think they even did a couple revisions of it, too. It was great because, you know, you have your guys go to a town, and you're like, well, what's this town like? Who's here? What's going on in the town? And then you could flip this open. You generally find out.
Well, you heard it. We just picked on BattleTech and elevated Shadowrun as the perfect example of how to do this.
It's not even a 10 episode.
You don't know.
From a standpoint of a role-playing game, you can see a similar problem with like Star Wars and Star Trek. That if you pick through all the various comic books and novels and such, you may get a really good sense of what's on some of the individual planets. But if you look at the role-playing resources, they don't put it together in a really clean fashion you can use. And as we keep saying, since the micro-setting is what is directly enabling the game, you have to make the stuff accessible. Because if your players are in a particular town and they choose on the run just to migrate to the next town over, you have to be able to quickly understand what's there and what's going on so you can keep that game moving. Now, granted, your plot may not be tied to any of these towns, but nonetheless, they've now walked into a place and you need to know, well, you know what? This particular town is not friendly to this race, or this particular town, you can't even buy this kind of supply that they're looking for anymore because they don't have it here.
That's when you demand a dexterity check, and no matter what they roll, they fall off into a box canyon.
A great cliff springs up in front of them, blocking them. Chad, you want to talk about...
It must be magic.
...in the micro setting, the problem of what you were calling a poke world.
There's two kinds of poke worlds that came up when we talked about this. Everyone's familiar with Pokemon. You know, the Japanese game, card game, video games, the whole franchise, cartoon, all that. One of the weird things about Pokemon when you watch the anime is that the entire world revolves around Pokemon. You go to a cafe, the cafe is Pokemon themed. You go to a hospital, well, there's no people hospitals, there's only Pokemon hospitals. The town, the architecture of the town is a sort of Pokeball Pokemon design. The only activity that anybody ever engages in are Pokemon battles or the support thereof of Pokemon battles. Every single town is the same. And the whole world is something that we call a poke world, where, you know, there's Pokemon churches, there's Pokemon everything. Nobody goes through their life without this cultural phenomenon of Pokemon deeply impacting their life and society. Life isn't like that. It works in the Pokemon thing, in the Pokemon universe. I mean, it's for little kids, it's light, it's fun, whatever. You have to avoid that concept, not necessarily Pokemon, when you write your serious
game. Never avoid Pokemon.
No.
Skies of Glass, they're going to be everywhere.
That's right. Mutated
little bell crops.
Yes.
I would say that I completely agree that you should avoid this, unless it's in your feel.
Say you have a fantasy game, and you go to a town, and this town makes daggers. Everybody in the town is carrying 10 daggers.
The inn is the blue dagger. The store is the red dagger.
It's Dagger Town in the...
They worship Daggercles.
Yep.
And the mayor of the town, is his proper title is the High McStabber. you could even see this in Post Nuke. One of the big things, and this was a little bit in Mad Max, but I've seen this in other Post Nuke as well, is motor obsessed societies.
Oh, yes. Right.
Where everybody's gasoline in cars and drives cars and this cars and that cars and the other cars and dune buggies, and it becomes kind of the singular theme mm-hmm. of it. And yeah, I mean, this may be relevant to whatever you're developing, but in all truth, it's probably not. And your world quickly becomes flat because everything just, there's no diversity to it. I mean, the real world, what makes it interesting is that people are different. There's so much different stuff right. going on.
You need diversity in your game. Lots of, and it's a diversity.
Different daggers.
Yes, exactly.
There's a dirk and a stiletto, and they have the other town, and they're going to be a fight.
That's right. A stabby fight, and everybody's going to get hurt. It's going to suck.
But it's only going to be 1d4, so it's going to take a long damn time.
It's a 200 years fight.
Yes.
Not war. Fight.
So, yeah, you want diversity, but you want it contained within your field document. That's why we say the field document is so important, because it provides the parameters and the framework for a consistent and diverse game. Because if you don't have that, suddenly these worlds that you're like, okay, I don't want to do this Poke World thing. I don't want to do the Mad Max thing. I want it to where everything is really diverse and going all which ways and stuff. So you make this town has magic and this town doesn't, and this town has this just wild stuff that goes, that flies off of your field document that can't even control it.
I think we're going back to setting bleed with regard to this topic. Make sure everything links.
Let's also talk about giving emotion to this. When you write these micro settings, you are not just giving hard facts that kind of give you the nuts and bolts what's going on in a town. For example, you could say that in this particular town, the farm fields got burnt during a recent war, and because of that, right now there's no food, so food is expensive, and you put a little footnote that looking off your main manual, multiply all food costs by 2 for this town. Okay, good information. But what that does not quite do is go that final step of really giving you a sense of what's going on there. Don't hesitate to add in some purely emotional information that draws you in, like talking about how the town square is daily filled by women weeping for food for their starving children, or talk about how there are riots that are occurring because of this, or
the mayor had to place guard around the grain stores and they've killed X number of town people in riots trying to get to the grain
stores. Or that the people are now angry at the other city, which did this to them, mm-hmm. because you are now creating an emotion that draws the players into the game deeper. And also by doing that little bit of stuff, putting that emotional spin to it above and beyond multiply food cost times 2, you're also now creating tons of plot opportunities. So someone quickly looking at this can say, hey, well, you know, my people might get paid off to go and bump off the mayor because he's starving the people out with what he thinks is a full food store, and have a great plot.
We have to negotiate, you know, the players have to negotiate some sort of peace in this war, bring in food from the other places, or they're bad guys and they do something to exasperate
the
situation.
Yeah, the players do whatever the hell they want. Yeah. They're the players.
Yeah, but the thing is this provides hooks. This provides tools for the GM to provide things for their players to do.
Your information also, in addition to being consistent, must also be accessible. We talked earlier about how you should have the same kinds of information on all your different areas just so you can quickly translate things from one place to the next. But this needs to be accessible because during the game, the party may move quickly from one place to the other, either at the GM's discretion or possibly just because of their own belligerence. But nonetheless, this is going to happen. They're migrating around. And as they do, you've got to remember there is some poor GM who is sitting there with your 200 or 300 page manual, who has to quickly find out when these guys brought their gold from one city to the next, what is it worth in the next city? And if it's buried in there somewhere under just who knows where in some piece of first person stream of consciousness fiction that you've got to ferret that out of, you've messed up this person's game. They've now got to take a 20-minute break to dig this up. So make sure people can find this stuff quickly.
So can you say that when you're doing the different settings and such for the different towns and areas and locales and people, can you have too much? Even if it's quality, good, important information,
I'll say the same thing I said about macro setting with regards to this. If you load it up and the players can't change anything, you've gone too far. Beyond that, I don't think so.
I think you could hit a point where just I mean, the mind can only absorb what the butt can endure. If you are providing so much information that is just intimidating that no one can possibly keep track of it or remember all the little nuances and paradoxes, yeah, you've created information that's effectively worthless. And if it's worthless, you might as well cut it out of the book. I will say, however, I don't know that I could name a game for you that has ever done this.
I couldn't.
I can visualize what this extreme would be like. I have never seen it.
I can say a product that I praised earlier, and that would be with Shadowrun, The Neo-Anarchist Guide to North America. Great book, tons of information, great example of it. If I could say one thing that was bad about it, almost too much. It was a brick of information.
I think you could also hit that point if it becomes distracting. This is something we talked about before the show. Like, for example, let's say you have a realm that has 10 major city-states, and you develop one of them almost more than you have the entire rest of the setting combined. Mm-hmm. And I realize for something like Greyhawk, that may be appropriate, but typically that's not intended or appropriate, and you can distract people away from what else is out there. Shadowrun did this with Seattle. Mm-hmm. They spent so much time pushing and developing Seattle, and I don't have a problem with that,
right.
But that at times it became very hard to really know what's going on elsewhere without going out and tracking down additional information.
Yeah. And if you're
going
to do that, do it. Just realize that you've made this place your macro setting, and that's what your game's about now.
Yeah, exactly. Everything else is just kind of the peripheral states right. that wander around the outside of that one setting. Now, granted, they did a better job developing that later, like mm-hmm. Chicago and right. the Neo-Anarchist Guide to North America.
And then the southern Mexican...
Oh, Aztlan or whatever.
Aztlan, yeah.
Aztlan.
No, Aztlan.
Oh, okay.
No, not Aztlan. There's a lion wandering around Mexico.
Yes. He's Jesus.
Helping children defeat witches.
You know what? It could work in Shadowrun. That's the scary
thing. Oh, yeah,
thing.
It could. I've seen more stupid, less stupid, mm-hmm. rather. Keep going, Dan.
Let's talk then about what we're doing for Skies of Glass and what you guys can expect to see in the resources document when we release this episode. What we're going to do is we have already created for our micro settings a template like we talked about earlier, where we have certain bullet points that we want to cover in the same order, nice and clean, for each of our individual cities or regions or counties or whatever we break each place down into. And by the way, this break is probably not going to be consistent. Just depending on how much is going on, we may have a whole micro setting entry for one city and then another one that covers like three counties out of a state just because there's nothing there or nothing going on or no distinction from one place to the next. But we are going to release that document. I am going to partially fill it out for a single location, just a sample location, fairly kind of generic wasteland type setting. And I'm only going to partially fill it out because some of the entries we have get into things like economy, which we haven't developed yet in our episode. So I don't want to release the economic information because you guys will be sitting there staring at it like, well, what does this even mean? Because we've come up with our own like units of currency and such. So I am not going to release that information, but I will still have for you the entry there. And I will have a note there kind of explaining what we will eventually put there just so you guys would know how to fill this out for your own.
Oh my God. It's an IOU resource document.
Nice. Feel free to modify this because we have picked the things that are important to enabling games in our setting.
Right. And remember what we said.
Your game is not our game.
Yeah. And remember what we said is that document is specific to each game. It changes from game to game. There is no one generic macro setting document that you can do.
Right, exactly. And be sure to do that as well with this micro setting. Modify this template to fit your game. If ours works for you, great, use it. If it doesn't, don't hesitate to start scratching things off. So
now the other Fear the Boot documents, you must use them exactly
yes,
how they
precisely.
Are. Otherwise, we're going to send ninjas to your house.
I've never seen a document
attorney
not
ninjas.
Fear the Boot compliant that we've put in the resources section.
Micro setting wrapped up. Let's do the Skies of Glass Q&A.
Questions!
And answers.
Questions.
Do we as the hosts have any questions?
No, we're making it.
If we the have only questions I had are going to become the topics of our next podcast.
So. Oh, yes. We have a next one's going to be an interesting one.
Dan, let me ask you this question.
The next one's going to be a dangerous one.
Yes, it is.
People walking around the world, what kind of guns are they carrying? Are they carrying pistols or assault rifles, bullet guns? Are they carrying lasers?
If we're talking
plasma
about
weapons,
Phil, like, all of the above.
Excellent.
And are people, triplicate.
Yes. Is it and nipples? Every time you glance away from his character sheet, he's got five more.
Actually, Chad, you should go check out the resources section on feartheboot.com. Because
yeah, where one of these things is actually released.
What's
yeah.
that website?
In the macro setting, we actually have an entry for a firearm in there. because I wanted to cover people's places and things. There's a gun in there. Really critical stuff to the setting.
Excellent, yes. What kind of gun you have.
And we're going to have pictures of guns and people gritting their teeth while shooting guns and getting shot by guns.
And a group of 4 to 6 people who look suspiciously normal holding guns looking awesome. And it won't be a gaming group, though.
No, not a gaming group.
With their guns.
That's right. People eating guns. Guns eating people.
All right. Today we're just going to do... Today we're just going to do one question from the forums. This comes from Shinan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
It's probably Shinan, but whatever.
Shinan, Shinan. I don't...
He can tell us who's right.
He can.
We'll just call him Shenanigans.
Or he can correct us all. Because he's from, you know, like, was the Netherlands. So he probably is capable of pronouncing phenomes that we cannot even say. So this...
The human ear can't even hear.
This may be like... We need, like, 6 cursed tongues to speak the syllable, and none of us possess that, so...
There's a click in there somewhere.
His question, and I'm going to boil it down, because he actually asked this in fairly long form, brought up a lot of individual nuances, I don't know that I want to tackle all of them, but the way his question generally boiled down was he wanted to know what was technology going to be like when the bombs are dropped.
Flying cars, spaceships, we've colonized half the galaxy.
And his question specifically, because we are having the nukes hit in 2109, which as of the recording of this podcast, I guess now in 2007, is 102 years in the future. So I guess if you want to put this in perspective, you can kind of look backwards to the very early 1900s. The difference between that and today is at least the distance we need to jump between here and 2109.
Not counting the exponentially quicker sharing of information.
Exactly.
Propelling our technology forward.
Probably needs to go even quicker for the reason John just gave, the fact that learning is speeding up. Some of this we are trying to step around because of the fact that we don't want to date ourselves. That if we talk about these super advanced things that sound impressive now and really are not impressive, or technology simply made a right turn and went a different direction, we'll look kind of stupid 10 years from now. I think I mentioned one of the previous podcasts reading a sci-fi book about the rocket ship being sent to Mars.
Yeah, and the idea of good people do this. I mean, read or watch 2001. Arthur Clarke thought we would have space stations.
Right, and you know, even then, it was this concept of something being sent to Mars wasn't what was so funny to me as the idea that it was a rocket ship that was being sent to Mars, not some kind of more reusable space vehicle.
And you know what? Even if we do turn out to be completely wrong in our predictions, we'll all be dead, so it won't matter.
In 10 years?
No.
What kind of life do you live?
In 2108, you're going to be alive?
No, in 2108, I won't be, but...
We could be quite wrong and look stupid by 2010.
Yeah, I mean, 10, 20 years from now, we could look stupid. So I think what we're going to do is this. We have to accept the fact that, yes, the world has advanced, and indeed advanced significantly between now and then. However, because of the fact that we nuked the world and blew up a lot of this technology...
Doesn't matter.
I mean, well, it will matter. It will matter, because the remnants of this stuff is still sitting around. In some cases, people may even still be employing it. But it is not going to be there on any great scale to where, if we were setting the game in 2109, we would have to develop the stuff in great detail. But now we don't anymore, because things like computers, whatever version they may be in by 2109, really aren't useful to someone who's... biggest thought is how to get the harvest watered in a year where there's no rain coming. And I realize places like Jacksonville that are being spared the nukes are going to also have this, but they've also lost the infrastructure. For example, imagine if the nukes went off today and only one particular city was really spared in its pre-bomb state. You're not using the internet. You may have some kind of local network that is similar that uses TCP/IP protocol and all those things, but the internet itself is gone. All those relays and all those websites simply aren't there anymore. Similarly, you're not going to be getting in, if we take St. Louis as being the one city left, we aren't going to be getting in tons of raw crude oil to refine down into gasoline. So while these things may still be a part of our setting, these are no longer a major part of our setting. Society has to find some other way around this. So we recognize that we've put ourselves in a little bit of a pickle being 100 years in the future, and that we have to develop these things somewhat. But we're going to try and cut some creative corners to avoid developing them to the point that we look stupid by the year 2015.
Yes. And we want you to feel like this is your world that's been blown to poop, not the future, which it's going to be.
Well, and you know what will help, too, is that the technologies and stuff might be different, but how you interface with them is still going to be the same. You could have some weird super magic computer that you still need an interface device, you still need an output device, so you're still talking like some sort of keyboard, some sort of viewing monitor screen. guns.
Well, I mean, you could even get into it. They're working on right now being able to do it just by putting electrodes on your head. I mean, not even permanent surgical implants. But I think, once again, we just don't necessarily have to define these things, right. And at least not at first. We can think about them a little and figure out which ones we need to define, which ones we don't need to define.
It's easier not to guess.
But, John brought up an important point, which is that one of the things we're kind of trying to hedge around is we did not want to set this in a world that is so futuristic no one can relate to it. Because if we nuke the Earth in the year 4000, it's going to feel like somebody else's planet. Even if it's the same place with the same locations, this is not the Earth you and I know. This is not like you could look out your window and think, man, what if a nuke went off right over there? And so we wanted to keep the setting, despite being in the future, such that we're going to enable some new technologies. We wanted to keep it similar enough to modern day Earth that people can still at least generally relate to the world that's getting nuked.
Something else that we did is, aren't there wars between then and now? And typically war distracts you from the great social hurdles you jump.
Yeah. Does wonders for technology, though.
Yeah. Yes and no.
Military technology.
Communications technology, space technology.
Concentrated orange juice came out of World War II. This is
nice.
One example.
There you go.
Spam.
So we definitely have some pitfalls we're going to have to watch for, but I think just as long as we set up all these events and all these technologies and the downfall of the world right, we can minimize, really, the number of pearls we're going to have to jump to get there. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Bye!
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.